Well, tonight we're making a short break in our regular series. We normally take a book of the Bible and kind of chew our way through chapter by chapter. We've done Micah, you'll remember last term. Next term, Revelation. We've heard that chapter 6 to the end, which should be an awesome time. We're all very nervous and anxious about that, but it should be a good time. Revelation is the happy hunting ground of every heretic. So let's see if we can get some heresy together as we... I was at Bible college, and in first year Bible college, this is totally, at first year, because this is a long weekend. What have you got to get home to? No one's interested in the game tonight, are they? So, first year Bible college, the lecturer said, we're going to talk about the heresies that have been around the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit. There's been a history, church history of heresy around that one. And he said, I want you to go and research one heresy and present it in 2 weeks' time to the class. And one girl put up a hand and said, can it be your own? Sure, if you've got a heresy you want to present, come and present it to us. It was kind of odd, but anyway, she was an interesting girl. We'll come to Revelation and we'll see how that runs for us. But what we're going to do tonight is break into this regular kind of pattern and look at one of the most wonderful passages in the Bible that's actually there. It's Romans chapter 8, verse 28. Have you ever been into one of those Christian bookshops? I haven't been in a Christian bookshop for 20 years, but if you've been into one of those Christian bookshops and they have those posters, the kind of fluffy kittens, you know, playing with balls of wool, and there'll always be a verse kind of stuck underneath it. Well, this is one of those verses you want to put on a Christian poster. You just don't want to ever put it with fluffy kittens, all right? And I'll tell you why, because this verse, when you understand it, has grunt. It has real power. It looks like it should be on one of those soft, fluffy posters. God loves, works for good, everything's going to work out, that kind of language. It sounds beautiful and nice. And it is a great comfort. It's an amazing verse. But tonight, as we dig into it, I want to show you there's real power to it. There is real grunt to it and real strength. And so here's the plan. I'm going to kind of take us through a couple of words by a couple of words, and then I'm going to go beneath it and try and understand the submerged pieces that are there that are not as evident. But let's take a look at it firstly just by noting we know that in all things God works for the good of those that love him. Verse 28, we know that in all things. Notice those two words, all things. What do those words mean, all things? What do they mean? What's another word for all things? Everything, all right? Everything is very basic. All things means all things. It means everything, just to make sure we got the point. But what I want you to notice is come back to verse 18. Flip all the way back to verse 18 of chapter 8. Put it in context. Do you remember when you've got to take a verse of the Bible, stick it in its context to make sense of what it means as it flows through? Verse 18, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Do you see that? I consider our present sufferings. So the author, Paul, is talking about suffering. He's talking about things that have come their way that are painful and difficult. He then goes on to explain in verse 19 and 20 and 21 that the creation is subject to frustration and pain. It's in the kind of pain of childbirth, all the grief that comes along with the groaning and hurt. Verse 22, it's been groaning as in the pains of childbirth. So what you've got is the context of suffering and pain. And then verse 23, he talks about us who have the Spirit, Christians. And he says, we ourselves have the first fruits of the Spirit. We groan. We groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. So he's drawing attention to the fact that the context we're living in, the world groans, there's sufferings, we groan. We groan waiting for our final salvation out of this groaning, hurting world. And in all of that, when you come to verse 28 and you notice the language of all things, it's not just all things, it's all things including difficult things, suffering things, painful things, hurtful things. Things where there's grief and agony in. And verse 28 is this wonderful promise that in everything, not just the nice things, not just the lovely things, not just the warm things, But the hard things, the painful things, the suffering things, the grief things, in all things, good and bad, God's at work. God is at work in everything. Now, in all of this, of course, there's an assumption that's worth making obvious in case it isn't obvious. And that assumption is simply this, that the New Testament expects that Christians will suffer. There is a brand of Christianity that peddles the notion that if you become a Christian, life will get smoother and easier and more wonderful, that relationship that's difficult will all just work out, that debt that you're in, if you pray, it'll all go and you'll become prosperous and you'll become healthy. If you're a Christian, the idea that's peddled is that things will get better and better for you. God is here to actually make your life wonderful and good. But when you look at the New Testament, what is clear and obvious is that there is the expectation of suffering and pain. Things will not get better and easier. That's the way things are meant to be. Now, what I want you to notice is that you've got this anticipation. Look at verse 24. Have a look there. In verse 24, in this hope we were saved. What hope? Well, the hope of redemption. That's what verse 23 has just said. In the hope of redemption of our bodies. But notice this. Hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? Do you see the point that he's making here? The point that he's making is that there is this anticipation and expectation for a great, wonderful future of the redemption of our bodies. One day we'll be released from the groanings of this world. But that won't be now. It won't actually happen yet. And so we hope for that. We wait for that. And his point is that you don't hope for things that you already have. You don't hope for things you already have. If you had all that heaven had to offer now, you wouldn't have to hope. And so the normal expectation is that there will be something coming that you don't yet have. You see, our world is broken. The biblical language is it's fallen. It isn't what it one day will be. It's a world full of pain, hurt, and suffering. And God's purpose is that this world will be finally eradicated, will be rescued to a new world where there'll be no more pain, death, suffering. Do you know that this last week we've had Val Warner. Some of you know Ricky and Ellen. Ricky's grandmother has died this last week. Now, you may not be aware that Ricky was raised by his grandmother because his mother had a terrible heart disease where she needed a heart transplant and spent most of her time in hospital, so couldn't raise her son, Ricky. And in fact, eventually died when the medication and so on, the heart rejected. And so he has lived with this constant, he's been raised by his grandmother because of the terrible grief that he's had to do, and she's now died. Friends, this world is not the way it's meant to be. Craig Dobby, many of you know Craig Dobby, well, his mother's died this week as well. That is a great grief for that family. Be praying for both these people as the funerals come up next week. God has saved us for a future that doesn't include these things. But brothers and sisters, Christians, you will be put through this as well. You will go through grief and suffering. And so we wait patiently in the midst of suffering for the hope that's yet to come. It's not yet here. But in the midst of all of that brokenness and fallen world that's so full of pain and groaning and agony, there's two hopes. One is that God will one day come and release us. The other is, Romans 8:28, he works in the midst of these things for good. He works all things, good and bad, for good, for the good of those that love him. Now, going a little further, what does it mean to say he works for good, the good? What is the good that he works for? So he works all things. Okay, he works the bad things and the good things. But he works them all for good. What's the good that he's working for? Well, you might imagine it's meaning this. It's not meaning this, but you might imagine that what Paul is saying is that he'll work things out so that all the terrible stuff will resolve itself and you'll have a happy life. Good. That's good. I've had a terrible series of relationships, but God will work it all and he'll make it all come together so one day it'll all be okay. You might imagine that's what it's saying. It'd be nice if that's what it was saying, but that's not what it's saying. Verse 29 tells you what the good is. What is the good that he's working for? Verse 29 starts with the word for, so it explains what's been said in verse 28. That's the way the language works. Because those that God foreknew, he also predestined, and he predestined them to be conformed to the image of his Son. What is the good that God is working for in your life? That you might be like Jesus. He's working all things, good and bad, and he's working in all of them for your good. And the good that he's working all those things for is that you might be conformed to the image of Jesus. That you might become more and more like Jesus. Now, that is a great comfort. If you think it's good to become like Jesus. If you long for a life of leisure and ease and comfort, then it's not much of a great verse at all. He's working all things so that I become like Jesus. Well, I would rather just have the sickness go. You know, some people buy into what I'm going to call theme park Christianity. Some people buy into what I'm going to call theme park Christianity. That is, they become Christians to get the theme park at the end of time. Now, I don't know whether theme parks actually excite you. For me, it's more that kind of island with a point break and a rolling left-hander that there's no one around and there's just friends and family to enjoy it with. You know, I mean, that might be. But some people become Christians to have that. Heaven's going to be that. And I become a Christian because I want to have that life. I want to have that thing. But that's not what God's about with you. He has saved you, rescued you in Jesus to make you like Jesus. And so he's working everything together that you might conform more and more to the image of Jesus. And if you become a Christian for the theme park, then you're on a collision course with God and his agenda for your life. Well, I want to have the fun. He wants me to be like Christ. Who's going to win? It won't be you. You know, it might be as you think about the theme park thing, I want to have a life that works. I want to have a life that's happy. Let me join that up a little bit with Jesus. There is something right and good about wanting a life that's good. Being made like Jesus is good. Being made like Jesus is your best life. It's our sin that hides how good it is to be like Jesus. It's our sin that thinks success and ease and comfort, that's really what would make my life good. It's sin that thinks that's where the best life's found. Whereas when you actually, do you remember some weeks ago we looked at Proverbs chapter 4, get wisdom. Though you have to sell everything you have, get wisdom. Get wisdom by first getting enough wisdom to realize you need to get wisdom. Some of you may remember Proverbs chapter 4. Well, one of the most important things, brothers and sisters, is that you get enough wisdom, just a taste of wisdom to realize you need wisdom for the greatest thing of your life. Getting enough wisdom will actually help you appreciate that the world around me and what it thinks is the good life is not good. The best life is being like Christ. Now, that takes conversion to see it. To be like Christ is to become clear-minded. It's to know what life and existence is about. It's to know why I'm here and what I'm here for, what matters most. It's to be connected intimately with the God of the universe. It's to learn to live by faith in him more and more, that I don't live in anxiety and fear and uncertainty. It's to be released from all of that and find security and stability and depth and strength. That's what it is to become like Christ, which will bring health and happiness in many ways. Do you know one of the things that actually Christians do enjoy better health? Do you know why that is? It's partly because Christians don't spend all their money on drugs and alcohol and cigarettes that destroy your life. And so we actually end up with more money and health alongside it. Because as you become more like Christ, you prioritize what matters, which is loving relationships, serving God by serving others. So you end up with friends more. You end up with people who care and you care. And you end up with a health that comes along with that. This is what God wants for you as you become more like Jesus. God is at work in all things to bring you the greatest freedom, the most beautiful life, the best life, which is to be like Christ. Now notice, the best life, the most beautiful life is to not be comfortable. It's not to have ease. To have the best life will mean work. It'll mean difficulties. It'll mean grief and pain. But count it pure joy, says 1 Peter 1 and James 1. Count it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds, because God uses these trials to produce in you many, many good, to form Christ. And so you care less about the circumstances of life. You care more about what he's doing in you to shape and change and grow you. And if you care about Christ being formed in you, the promise is this, that everything that happens in your life will produce him. There's nothing that'll be wasted. God will work the difficult things, the sicknesses, the death around you, the loss of the job, the betrayal that happens, the work that fires you. He'll work all of those things. If you cooperate, he'll work all of those things to produce Christ in you, to make someone who trusts God more, who looks to eternity more, is freed from worrying about the things of the world more, who knows what love is about. You see these things that God will develop in your life. You know, there was a story told to me years ago, and I don't know if it's true, and in one sense I don't really want to know if it's true, because if it's not, it ruins a great illustration. And so I don't want you Googling just to check whether this is the case or not. But there's a caterpillar that, of course, like all caterpillars, forms a cocoon, and it metamorphizes and becomes a butterfly and kind of eats its way out of the cocoon and emerges as a butterfly. There was a story about this person who was watching a butterfly in its cocoon chewing a small hole in the cocoon to kind of squeeze itself out. And it only chewed a very small hole, and so it had to work over a period of hours to try and get itself out through this hole. And with this person was a great, you know, a loving person. And so they got a knife and cut the cocoon open so that it didn't have to squeeze its way out through this terribly small hole, only to find that that loving act actually destroyed the caterpillar, because it was the caterpillar came out deformed, because squeezing through the small hole was the way by which the fluids were forced down to the tips of its wings. So when it came out fully formed. It was actually the tortuous process of coming through the hole that formed it to be all that was intended. And in this person's soft-hearted sentimentality, they actually destroyed the very thing they were trying to rescue. Now, here's the point. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's a great illustration. It's an illustration that's helpful to actually understand what God's doing in your life. Friends, this is not to say that you should pursue difficulties and find the hardest path in life. Not saying that at all. But God will bring difficulties in your life. He is working all things, good and bad, to actually form Christ in you. And it's in the context of the difficult things. It's in the context of working through grief and pain and hurt that you learn obedience. You learn to trust God more. You become more and more like Christ. And so you emerge through all of that, mature and deep and with roots. If you do actually seek to avoid anything that's hurtful and painful, you'll find yourself with a life that's shallow, with no character and no depth. Now, this is God's great promise to give us good things, Christ. Now, who is it for, though? Who is this promise to work all things for good for? Well, you look at the verse 28. Who's it for? It's for those who love God. They're the ones that God is focused on to bring about this good, which immediately begs the question tonight, are you someone who qualifies? Are you someone who loves God? Because if you're one who loves God, then he's working to bring all things in your life for your good. But if you don't love him, then it's not a promise for you. Well, how do I know if I love God? and so am this person. Well, the difficulty is emotions go up and down. Some days I feel like I am qualified as one who loves God. Some days I don't feel that way. I want to show you a few things in the verse that actually helps you work out whether you are that person or not. I want you to notice this. Have a look in verse 29. In verse 29, you get the beginning of what's called the golden chain. Those God foreknew, one link in the chain, he also predestined, the next link in the chain, to be conformed to the image of his son. Down to verse 30. And those he predestined, he also called, the next link. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he glorified. Now it's called a golden chain because each link in the chain secures you unbreakably from where you are now to the final endpoint being glorified. And I want you to notice this in verse 30. It's easy to pick it up there. That what Paul is saying is that those that God predestined, he called. Everyone that was predestined by God, he called them. And notice the verse, everyone that he calls, he justifies. God doesn't fail. He doesn't call someone to himself and find that they resist him and won't come. No. If he's called, then that person is justified. But notice further, every single person who's justified, he brings to glory. Irresistibly, unfailingly, he brings every justified person to glory. It's a great comfort about the sovereignty of God. But what I want you to notice is this, those who love him are those who have been called according to his purpose, and those who are called are, verse 30, those who are justified. Now that gives you a help to know whether you're on that chain, because how do you know whether you're justified? Being justified is being right with God. How do I know if I'm someone who's right with God? Well, anyone who puts their trust in Jesus is justified. Anyone who looks to the works of Jesus instead of their own merits is justified, right with God. So how you know whether I'm in that chain, someone who's been foreordained, predestined, called, justified, glorified, how do I know I'm on that chain? Have I got faith in Jesus? Have I put my faith in Jesus? Well, if you have, then you are one who has been called according to God's purpose. You are one that verse 28 applies to. It's for you, this verse. Your feelings of love may go up and down, but the reality of whether you've trusted in Jesus should stand firm. As an experience that I know is the case, my love rises, falls, but I trust in Jesus as my only hope. Well, this verse is for you. Now, all of that's the big piece of Romans 8:28, and it's a great verse, that if you are someone who trusts Jesus, and so you're someone who loves Jesus, that's what the same thing, then God is at work in everything that comes in your life to bring you to become more like Christ and will glorify you one day. But I want to take you a little bit deeper for a moment. The submerged truth that's here is a powerfully important one, and I want to bring it to the surface. What's that submerged truth? Well, the submerged truth that operates in verse 28, 29, and 30 is that God is sovereign over all things. Let me just spend a couple of minutes with you on this, and we'll actually have a question time briefly. I think we'll get there. So if anything gets triggered for you, we'll have a moment at the end. But I want you to work hard at verse 28 with me in 29. My son-in-law shared with me a sermon that he said you really need to listen to. This sermon's really good. And so I went and listened to someone called John Piper, something like this. And so anyway, I went and listened to this Piper sermon, which was very good, and I encourage you. It was about bondage of the will, and it is worth chasing up. But during the sermon, Piper used this line, which I think is very, very good. He said, Oh, to have a church full of Christians who bang their head against the Bible until it releases its treasures. I thought that was a great line. And what he was saying is, don't be superficial in your Bible reading. It's a beautiful picture, isn't it? Bang your head against the Bible until you actually see what it's really saying. Don't just read and drift. Keep working at the text and working at the text. Now, Romans 8:28 is like this. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. We know that in all things God works for the good. What does that mean about God, that he can work in all things? What kind of God does he have to be able to be the God that can work in all things? And take it another way. If I want to draw comfort from this verse, so I've lost a child. I've been waiting for the birth of this child. The child's born and it dies. Terrible circumstances, the hospital, malpractice. Now, someone says to me, Romans 8:28, God works in all things for good. If that is a comfort to me, it can only be a comfort to me if I believe that God can work in terrible things. That God can be at work in even the death of a child. Do you see? Because if God can't be in bad things, if Satan's only the one who does bad things and God does good, Satan does bad, God does good, if that's the way you think about the universe and the way God is, then bad things, I can't believe that God's in them because Satan's in them. I hope he'll clean it up and make something good out of it, but the verse doesn't say he'll clean it up and make something good out of it. It says God's actually at work in it for good. For that to be a comfort, I've got to know, which is the submerged truth here, that God is actually sovereign over even bad things, so that I can be assured that he is even at work in this, as painful as it is. Do you see? It's the submerged truth. There's no comfort in this verse unless you're convinced of that truth. Now, there's the thinking on it. Let me show you what the Bible actually says. Come and have a look with me a few Old Testament passages. Exodus chapter 4. Flip all the way back to Exodus. I'm going to pick a couple of passages that are kind of like landmark parts in the Old Testament where God reveals his character. These are not just obscure verses. These are contexts where God says, take a stop and listen to who I am. And in Exodus chapter 4, God does this with Moses. And look at verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Now, who do you think it is who makes people blind? Who do you think it is that makes people deaf and unable to speak? Who is the one who does that? Well, you look at verse 11 and what does it tell you? It's the Lord God who does that. God says to Moses, is it not I, the Lord, who does these things? Now go, I will help you speak, because of course I'm in control of all things. Come with me to Deuteronomy 32, another context that's massively significant. Come with me to 32, Deuteronomy 32, a couple of books to your right. Look at verse 39. See now that I myself am he. There is no God beside me. I put to death and I bring to life. I have wounded and I will heal. And no one can deliver out of my hand. You see what God's saying? I am the great sovereign God over life and death. I heal and I wound. And no one, no one can deliver out of my hand. If my hand is on you, if I have you, I will bring you to the end. No one can take you from me, because I'm the sovereign, powerful God who hasn't got any other enemy that I need to compete with. There's no great power in the universe that I'm in some arm wrestle with. There's not some evil force that brings death and I have to keep turning it back into life all the time. No, I'm the one who's sovereign over life and death, says God. Have a look with me at Isaiah 45. Flip over there. Now, this is the context in the book of Isaiah where God spends a great deal of time saying who he is and what he's like. And there's one verse that particularly is relevant for us tonight. Have a look at chapter 45, verse 7. Actually, start at verse 5 to get some context. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Apart from me, there is no God. I will strengthen you, though you have not acknowledged me. So from the rising of the sun to the place of its setting, people may know that there is none besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no God, no other. I form light and create darkness. I bring prosperity and create disaster. I, the Lord, do all these things. There is no evil power out there that brings bad and I try and make good. I'm the one in control of all things, good and bad. This is an extraordinary expression of the power and might of God. And if you've lived with the kind of popular mythology about God, that he's the God of the rainbow and Satan's the God of the storm and God keeps bringing rainbows out of Satan's destroying of the storms, then you've not understood the Bible. And you've got a God who actually isn't able to keep you safe. He's not a God that you can trust with all things. But when you hear this teaching, you actually hear that there is a God that I can entrust everything to and be confident that in every circumstance of life, whether good or bad, God is in control. And I can rest in him. Now, this raises some massive questions. Does this mean that God is to blame for bad things? Does it mean that he's to blame for sin and evil? The Bible is emphatic and says no. James chapter 1, verse 13, God is not the author of sin. But it does teach, the Bible does teach that God, though not the author of sin, is sovereign over it. I don't know how that works. It makes no sense to me in my brain, but the Bible clearly teaches it. That God is sovereign over good and evil. He stands behind good directly, but he stands behind evil as well, just not directly. He's not the author of evil, but he's sovereign over. It's the best I can do. The Bible teaches it, and so I believe it. And I need to believe it. Because if God is not sovereign over evil, then who knows that evil might not get the upper hand one day? Well, because God's so powerful, he's powerful over it. You come back to Romans 8, 28. It's a great verse. It's a great verse of great comfort for those who are going through difficult times, that God works in the difficult times for good. Trust him. But submerged beneath it is this conviction and truth that God is able to work in all things because he's sovereign over all things. He will bring me through all things, no matter how difficult and painful they are. There's no power in heaven. There's no demonic force. There's no evil in the world that's great enough to undo God or me if I'm with God. No one can snatch me out of his hand. Now, all of this is a great encouragement and a great challenge. And let me just remind you of the challenge. I'm almost finished. I've got a story I want to finish with, but I'll pause and see if there's any questions. The challenge is this. The good that he will bring is Christ-likeness. It's a challenge to us to see how precious being like Christ is actually to us. You know, one of the reasons God tears down our health, one of the reasons he doesn't give us the things we ask for sometimes, is because he wants us to learn that there are more precious things in life than you just getting what you want. The more precious thing in life is to be like Jesus, to learn to wait patiently on your Father, and look to Him. And it's God's grace and kindness to take some things from us, painful though that might be. Now, I say only some things, because some things are taken from us because God has other purposes. There is much that's complex and difficult here. There are many mysteries. But in all of this, don't lose the powerfully important truth that God works in all things, suffering, pain, hurt, grief. He works in all of that. He is sovereign over all of that. And He is working in all of that for your good. To be like Christ. Now, I have a story to finish with, but I want to actually pause and see. Do you want to have any? Are there any questions or comments you want to make? Anything that kind of is left a little uncertain, unclear? Any questions? Yeah.
What ought we think about the work of Satan? How Satan? What's he actually doing when we have a sovereign God who is over things?
Yeah. It is complex, and thanks for that question, Dan. Have a look at Job 2. Come and have a look at Job 2. Job 1, actually. Start at Job 1. We'll read the first two chapters. Have a look there in verse 6. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him, blameless, upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the works of his hands. That's why he loves you," do you see? Verse 11, "But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power, but the man himself do not lay a finger." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and took away all his children, killed them, took away all his property, destroyed that. Satan worked to do what he said he was going to do. What I want you to notice is extraordinary things. Chapter 1, verse 21, Job says in response to all that's been taken from him by Satan, "Naked I came from my mother's womb." It's been a long weekend. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away." Now notice that. The Lord has taken away. I thought Satan did it. What the Bible teaches is that Satan only did it under the permissive will of God. And so Satan is an evil power opposed to the things of God, but under the permissive power of God sovereignly, only doing what God permits him to do, and doing that which I take it secretly God allows and permits and wills, because by it God actually works his saving purposes. By it God actually works an even greater thing. So there is an evil, malevolent power that thinks it has power, but is really only held in check at every moment, at every second, at everything it does by God himself. And such is the perversity of Satan that Satan thinks he's free, but is not at all. And thinks he's trying to win and may one day, but can't ever because God is the sovereign. There's the perversity of humankind as well. That we think that we're independent of God and we can do what we like. You are not independent of God. God rules your every moment. Don't fight against him. You'll find yourself fighting against the great sovereign Lord of the universe. A Lord who loves you. Why would you fight against him? So there are mysteries here. And I take it God uses the evil powers, the evil principalities and powers. They think they're free. He uses them to achieve his salvation purposes, to bring greater glory to his Son and us who are joined to himself. There was a question here that might be easier.
How do we handle images
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's a good question, and it's probably harder than that one. Thank you. It's a good question. So what do we make of? What do we make of? It may not just be the TV, but what do we make of those that are around us who are dying, who don't know Jesus? Has God thrown these people away? No, there's far more going on. There's a number of kind of things that you need to recognise the Bible's teaching. The first one is the Bible is clear and adamant. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. He brings life and death. The sovereign Lord does all these things. But does that mean he's just raising people up like puppets to crush them cruelly in some game? Well, he says not at all. Because those creatures that he's sovereign over do have the ability to make our own choices. Not free choices, but choices that are really our choices for which we're responsible and accountable. So those people that ignore God and throw themselves, determined to throw God off and live without him and die without God, without hope, without the knowledge of Jesus, have done it by their choice. And so there's heartbreak, there's hurt, there's anguish over the choices they've made that have meant they've now not got God forever. But in the midst of that, I need to hold on to the deeper and more extraordinary truth that God is even sovereign over that in some fashion. Not by playing a game, but in a real, deep, profound way, God is the Lord of every human. Now, I know he's not playing a game with the lives and souls of men and women. I know he's not playing a game because he's the same Lord whose nature is always to have mercy, who sent his son, his only son, to die for us. So I know he's not playing a game with people if he's revealed himself to be a God of such love. But I don't then go to some simplistic notion that because he must be a God of love, the way I conceive love is that he'd have everyone and he would make everyone come. And the Bible doesn't teach that. It won't let you go down that path. And there's complexities here that we need to recognise as well. What I want to do is push you to see, bang your head against the Bible. Bang your head against the Bible to see what it's actually saying. Because what it's actually saying is deeper and more profound than you'd ever imagined. God is a God of love, but he's also sovereign. As you come with us through the book of Revelation next term, one of the things that will be very evident is again the sovereignty of God, but the perversity of humankind that even confronted with the sovereignty of God refuses to actually bow the knee and shakes their fist at him. One of the great comforts here, of course, is that because God is sovereign, I can pray to him for the salvation of my friends in our world. So CMS Missionary Day, you ought to come along and find out a bigger heart to pray for the world. Because when you see on TV people lost and dying like that without Christ, what's the answer? Pray for people to go on missionaries. Pray for people to go and preach the gospel. That it wouldn't happen anymore. That God in his sovereign kindness might raise up workers for the harvest, says Jesus. Pray to the Lord of the harvest. Pray to him to raise up workers, to send out, to actually bring the word of grace to people around us that they might not die in their sin under the sovereign hand of God. There are mysteries here and I don't think I've explained them all, but let me finish with a story. It's a true story. It's a story of a man who understood these things, that God is at work in all things as the sovereign Lord working good. It's a man called Horatio Spafford. Some of you may have heard of him. He lived 150 years ago in the 1800s. And he knew what suffering was. He was a wealthy man because he'd invested a lot of his money in property through Chicago. And if you know your history, though it's a very obscure piece of history for us, in 1871, all of Chicago burnt down. And so all the property that he had was lost. All the buildings and so on. And so it, it impacted him massively, and it was a lot of grief associated with it, of course. Then 2 years later, there was a Great Depression that swept through that region, and again, he lost a great... He was in deep distress. They were, when they had a lot of money, going to travel to Europe across the Atlantic Ocean, he and his wife and four daughters. He couldn't go because of the circumstances he was in, trying to fix things up. He sent his wife and four daughters by boat to go on the journey themselves. But on the journey, the boat that they were on crashed into another boat in the Atlantic and sank. All four daughters drowned. He received a telegram, which is the way you communicated back then. He received a telegram after the disaster from his wife. And I can give you word for word what was said in the telegram. It's a very famous telegram. His wife wrote, "Saved alone." That was it. Now, he rushed to his wife to comfort her, so got on a boat to travel across in great grief himself. And as he travelled to meet his wife, as he went past, so it said, as he went past the region where the disaster occurred, he wrote a song. And it's one of the most famous songs that we still sing today. And it's titled, "It Is Well With My Soul." Listen to these words. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to know, it is well with my soul. Though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, let this blessed assurance control, that Christ has regarded my helpless estate, he hath shed his own blood for my soul. For me, be it Christ hence to live. If Jordan above me shall roll, no pang shall be mine, for in death as in life, thou wilt whisper thy peace to my soul. And Lord, haste the day when my faith shall be sight, the cloud shall be rolled back as a scroll, the trump shall resound and the Lord shall descend, a song in the night, O my soul. It is well with my soul." How do you write a song like that? Because he understood the great sovereignty of God who was working all things. He understood the love of God. He understood the heart of God, that there is a future stored up. And so he waited patiently in the midst of his grief. He entrusted himself to a Father who loves, who is sovereign and powerful, that he was never outside of his will and purpose and hand. And so he entrusted himself to God and knew that in the midst of it all, the great thing was that it was well with his soul. He was right with the Holy God of the universe. Now, after all of that, after writing such a song and suffering so much, he had three more kids. But one of them died, his only son, aged 4. Died of scarlet fever. He didn't give up the faith. He didn't imagine that life was just going to bring him one beautiful moment after another. He knew that we live in a world that's groaning. He knew that he lived under the hand of a sovereign God. He knew that there's a future stored up with him. So he and his wife went to Israel and started a mission to the Jews, and continue to labour for the Lord in that context. Friends, can I urge you to realise life will not just be one wonderful adventure. Life won't be some great wonderful adventure. It will have much pain and hurt in it. But in the midst of it, know that God is sovereign. He is sovereign over everything. And you can entrust yourself to him. He's revealed himself to be a God of love with his sovereignty. And you can be sure that he'll be at work in all things to bring out good in you, the good of the formation of his Son in your life.